Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced at the Melbourne Community Support Program and brought to you through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and welcome to Listen to Older Voices and the third and final part of the story of one of the true Australian baby boomers, David Pepperell. A semi-frustrated singer, David had tasted success in the developing Melbourne music scene of the 1960s. However, not content to be an observer, he dipped into songwriting, with successful songs for Norman Gunston and Mondo Rock. Along with a friend, he opened the wildly successful and first import record store, Archie and Jughead's. He becomes published, works as a rock journo and columnist until he becomes a victim of his own success and his alternate persona, the Wild Dr. Pepper, which becomes the dominant personality. In many ways, there's not been a Listen to Older Voices like this one. David helped shape and shared in the developing music and countercultural literary scene, and now is sharing these stories with us. He may now be an older voice, but it's a voice that has said much and still has much to say. Now, let's get back to David. Move into the 70s and the music's still strong, but it died. What happened?
It took a long time to die. When pub rock first started in Melbourne, was a hotel called the Queensbury Hotel, just outside of town, which was really started by a group of people that I knew very well, and included me. That in 66 had been a venue on the corner of Queensbury Street and Swanston called Chicago, which had been run by a friend of ours, and they wanted to do an R&B gig. So the first night they were on, they actually had the Purple Hearts, which I think was possibly their first gig in Melbourne. But of course they got the Roadrunners, or the AKA the Delta Set, to play there because they were a real R&B band. And that gig sort of, you know, died in the end because we all got kicked out for drinking too much. And the police didn't like coming in and cleaning it all up the next day. But we had started drinking at the Queensbury Hotel across the road, which is diagonally opposite. And my friend Mark Barnes asked the publican, you know, could we put bands on in the back room? And he started doing that. It was enormously successful. And it was the first hotel really in Melbourne to put a rock and roll band on. It was funny that when 10 o'clock closing came in 66, all the hotels seemed to think more in the term of cabaret acts or TV acts.
Yes.
Of putting, you know, Bill Mc... what's his name?
Irish singer.
The Irish singer. Yes. Bill McCormack on, or Tony Lamond. They had the idea of it was like going to be a family kind of night. Nobody seemed to twig the idea of putting rock and roll bands on license. So the Queensbury was a huge success and went for a couple of years after that. Then it kind of died down a bit until Mark, who'd run that, you know, started the Station Hotel in 1971.
Now, again, for people listening into the Station Hotel is in Parram.
Station Hotel in Greville Street, Parram.
It was really starting to happen, wasn't it?
The Station Hotel really set the template for pub rock in Melbourne. It was the first real rock and roll pub in Melbourne since the Queensbury. Queensbury wasn't as well known and didn't have major bands on, really. It mostly had fairly low-key bands. People just loved seeing a band where you could drink.
Yes.
I remember the first afternoon I compared and Keith Glass's band played, we just packed the place out with no advertising, just totally word of mouth.
Yeah.
So it just went on. It started off just being Saturday afternoons, and it was Saturday night, and it was Friday night, and by, say, 73, it was every night of the week and Saturdays and Sundays. I saw AC/DC play there, I saw Cold Chisel play there, putting on every major band in Australia. By about 74, there was an amazing pub rock scene in Melbourne with, again, so many venues. And big places like Bombay Rock opened up, which was an old Greek nightclub in Brunswick, and they secured the first 3 a.m. license for a rock and roll venue, so you could rock on there till 3 o'clock in the morning.
And could I throw another one in? TF Much.
Well, TF Much is a trifle earlier. TF Much is late 60s, early 70s. That, again, was unlicensed. TF Much was a fascinating place because it was put together as a total hippie gig. It was really hippie Melbourne. A lot of the bands like Spectrum and Daddy Cool and Lip and the Double Decker Brothers, these sort of more unusual kind of acts started playing there that weren't really geared towards pub rock or geared towards television that were really were kind of hippie bands.
Yes.
And the TF Much things were enormously popular, despite being unlicensed. It was in a big hall in Fitzroy. And they did that as a scene. I mean, it wasn't just a dance. There were places there you could buy food and drink and everything, and you could just kind of hang out there. Just really what the station and those places became in the end. They really were virtually clubs. Melbourne was booming even more in the early 70s, I think, than really in the 60s. There was just so many places. They were just everywhere.
One of the big hits in the 70s, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was around 73, was The Day the Music Died.
By Don McLean.
When did the music really die in Melbourne? Because it was such a big scene. When did it die and why did it die?
Depends what kind of music you like. I mean, I think the music died around 76 when the whole pub rock thing went punk. When all of the bands that had built up for a long time were just suddenly swept away by the whole phenomena of punk rock. What it was generational change. I've got to think like in 1975 I turned 30. And so did, you know, most of my contemporaries. So there was a whole new generation. And also our music had become less dance-oriented and more listening-oriented. They started calling that music shoegazers in England, which I thought was a really funny term. But it was kind of guys looking at their shoes when they played.
Yeah, the endless 30-minute solos.
That's right.
Yes.
And, I mean, rock and roll had become almost like jazz. It was long improvisations, you know, long playing by very skilled musicians. You know, the level of playing and virtuosity was really extraordinary. So that scene, you know, certainly, you know, went those years. It had died. Then it was taken over by the whole Boys Next Door scene. But, I mean, I can't say it died because there was still an enormous scene in Melbourne. There was still the Prince of Wales and the Esplanade and the station. Some of those places went because the people who ran them didn't really understand the new music. But what it was there wasn't the money in it. The pulling power of those sort of bands just didn't seem to be the same as the pulling power of the bands before. The big festivals died because those bands couldn't really, you know, Sunbury had gone by 75. I think the last Sunbury was 75. Punk managed to go until 82, but it just seemed as if there wasn't the record sales in it at all. And those bands, because their music was also fairly abrasive and I think more aggressive, it tended to scare a lot of the girls off. No scene works without girls. And, you know, girls felt quite okay going to the station, those sort of places. And the music, even though it was bluesy, was primarily melodic. It wasn't aggressive. Whereas what a lot of the punk groups were doing was very aggressive, and the dancing, you started to smash into each other on the dance floor and pogoing and all of that. And it created a scene where, you know, that mothers didn't really like their kids to go to and things like that. So that's my theory anyway. And the music didn't resound on the charts as much as it did. And also the television, virtually faded away. Because, again, the punk bands weren't selling records and weren't really pop-type bands to go on television. You know, it became difficult to field a television show. Music went from being all-encompassing. Up to 1976, like, music was everything. Music was the dominant paradigm. Everything was related to music. I was in the music retail business then. Like in 1974, the music retail business turned over four times the film business.
Now, you actually had one of Melbourne's, if not the first, one of the first record shops, the independent record stores, didn't you?
We had the first import record shop in Australia.
Called?
Archie and Joe Kids Records.
Located?
In the city, initially on Bourke Street, and then we moved to off Collins.
Was it popular?
Enormously popular. It went beyond our wildest dreams. In 1971, I was trying to think of something to do. What was really difficult before the import shop scene started was actually getting records. There were no imported records available in Melbourne except it was jazz and some classical at places like Thomas's and Discurio and some folk, because the local record companies didn't care about that much. But they'd been very heavy on anybody who tried to import records in the pop area. And the release in Australia, I think, was extremely poor. You know, I'd be kind and say about a third of what was available overseas was available here, but I suspect it was less. Even figures of 25% have been quoted. But I certainly knew that so many records that I like, things like Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, the Mothers of Invention, these weren't available in Australia. So I thought, you know, what would I like to walk in and into? What kind of shop would I like to walk into? And Keith Glass and I got together and through a great deal of effort and a great deal of luck, managed to get a shop going and get a shipment in. And the first shipment I ordered in, I didn't order a single record that was actually available in Australia. I ordered about 1,000 records. Something like, maybe 600 titles, because I didn't get that many copies of each. And there wasn't a single record there that you could actually get here. So I ordered that, and the day we opened, we took $1,000. It was extraordinary, and it just went like a bomb.
Yes.
And we went from a little room upstairs off an arcade in Bourke Street to a shop in a lane off Collins Street alongside what later on became John and Merivale. We started, and we had the market pretty much to ourselves for the first year, which was pretty good.
Yes.
So we made hay while the sun shines. But that was just it, that the companies, you know, mounted all sorts of nasty legal attacks against us, but never actually got round to actually suing us and putting us out of business, which they could have done. And so we were just selling records like they were going out of style. The amounts we were selling in those days were extraordinary, but mainly because you couldn't buy them anywhere else.
Exactly.
And also, there was a thing in Australia then that they liked building up demand. And what a lot of people don't know is that, like, when Sgt. Pepper came out in Australia, it was a month after it had been available overseas.
Yes,
they waited 4 weeks. And so built up demand. But by that, we were waiting 4 weeks for the latest thing. It's like it was ridiculous.
Yes.
Because the latest thing in the world in those days was records.
Yes.
When a new record came out by a major group, that was the form. The new Doors album, the new Rolling Stones album, the new Jefferson Airplane album, you know, the new Beatles album, of course. So we started getting things in, you know, like at exactly the same time it was out in the United States. So when the new Rolling Stones album came out, we had it, you know, that same week it was out in Los Angeles and Britain.
No wonder you made a lot of enemies in the conventional
world. We certainly made a great number of enemies, because we were, you know, weeks ahead of them, because they'd never really had to rush, they didn't bother.
Yep.
And by us doing that, in the end, by the end of the 70s, we had a simultaneous release here in Australia. They had to compete with us.
And this is Listen to Older Voices. Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with David Pepperell, and David's relating stories of his time as the co-owner of Australia's first imported record shop, Archie and Jughead's, in Melbourne in the 1970s.
The big thing about imports was that they had tremendous covers and cover art,
yeah,
and all sorts of stuff, books and all,
yes,
sorts of stuff, which again, as the monopolistic companies out here didn't have to do them, they didn't.
No.
So we were buying a very inferior product here for the same money as you were paying overseas.
And even the local pressings were terrible, weren't they?
Well, the pressings had never really improved much from the age of 78. They still had old engineers who would never, for example, dip into the red on a VU meter, whereas overseas they were going right into the red because they realised that would give you more punch out of the grooves on a small record player.
Yes.
Up to about, you know, like, say, early 70s, most people still had small record players. Modular record players really became more popular as the 70s progressed. But before that, most people just had a little suitcase record player with a sapphire needle. You needed a fair bit of volume out of that, you know, and most Australian records wouldn't produce that volume. When you put an import record, that was twice as loud.
Now look, I think we could probably spend another hour talking on the Australian music scene, but time is tight. And what I'd like to do, there seem to be two really important facets to your life, music, but you also started off talking about literature and writing. Now, I know you're very big into writing. When did that start and how did that come about?
I was always interested in writing. I don't know. Look, probably genetic. My dad was so interested in literature and writing from very early on. He read voraciously. Like a lot of people his generation, he'd left school in third form, which was called proficiency in those days, probably because of the war. I don't exactly know. But in those days, if you had proficiency, that was enough to get you a clerical job. And he started out in a clerical job. But he read all the time. Also, I was good at reading. I always found reading very easy, and it came to me very simply. And I just loved reading. So from very early on, I mean, I started off with Biggles, Leonard Blyton, that I read voraciously, and just continued on from that. So, and I was good at composition at school, and I was fascinated with the romance of writing. I think, look, I never really wanted to work. Work always looked horrible to me. When I realised when I was about 12 that I was going to have to work the whole of my life because I was a boy and I wasn't just going to marry somebody and be a housewife and have children, it was a big shock to me. And I thought, well, how can I, you know, get out of this? So it came to me that I could be a writer, because when I used to watch the Sydney Sound Review and the newsreels, all they ever used to have was Hemingway at the bullfights. And I thought, well, there you go. And I used to, you know, I used to see John O'Hara or John Steinbeck going somewhere famous or on these trips. They interview, you know, they're big celebrities. And I thought, well, look, you're right. You just do it at home. You don't have to clock on. It's a job and you become famous and you sell lots of books. It seemed like an extremely good living to have. So I wrote. Friends at school used to call me the imitation Enid Blyton. I used to write imitation famous five books all the time. Anyway, so I continued on with it, but not very successfully. When I left school in 62, I got a job in a clerical, and I used to keep on writing, but I never seemed to have any great success at it. And I wrote poetry as well, which I never had any great success at either. And later on, I started thinking, well, I should write rock criticism. In late 60s, I wrote stuff and sent it to Go Set, but that seemed to wind up in the bin as well. So I became a bit disconsolate. But when I got a job in 1968 working in books at the Melbourne University Bookshop, it kind of revived it all for me. I'd never really given it up, and I'd never stopped writing, but I'd stopped sending stuff to publishers and things, and I thought, look, I'm just never going to make it. And in 1968, I started a correspondence with the American writer Anais Nin. Well, I read one of her books, her first volume of her diary, and I was so taken with it because I was a big Henry Miller fan, despite the fact I couldn't read any Henry Miller much at that time. You couldn't read his controversial books, but I managed to read his essays or anything else that I could get. I loved his writing dearly. So I wrote to Anais Nin just a big fan letter after I read her book. And I'd done that before. I'd written to a number of people. I'd never got a reply. Anyway, amazingly enough, 2 weeks later, I got this tremendously warm reply from her, you know, inviting further correspondence. So I started writing to her on a regular basis. And I told her I thought of myself as a writer, even though, again, I'd never been published. And she encouraged me enormously. So I started to get interested in writing again. And I had some poetry published. But what really turned it was when I started the shop, that once I started the shop, I became a bit of a celebrity because the shop was very well known. I became a bit of a man around town. A newspaper had started called Daily Planet, new pop paper. So I thought, shit, look, I'll send them something, because I was always writing stuff. And so I sent them stuff, and lo and behold, they published it. And the editor rang me up and he said, oh, I love this. Can you send us some more stuff? So I thought, it's all happened.
Yes.
So I then became like a, you know, like a real staff member at Daily Planet till it folded about 6 months later. And when that folded, I mailed off another piece to Go Set, which was the major pop paper at that time. And they immediately took that. And then I started writing for them. And so I basically wrote for everybody for the next 5 years.
Listen to Older Voices. Living History on Ageless Radio.
Now, very interestingly, early in our talk together, you mentioned how, from a very early age, you developed this persona in order to cope, and it was one you found hard to throw off. And in some ways, that persona developed even more during your writing career, didn't it?
Oh, totally, yes.
Until it took over, is that not correct?
It took me over, yes. It was a sort of a Jekyll and Hyde. Yes, well, my writing career culminated in 1975 when I started writing for Duke magazine via Ed Nimmervoll, who'd been the editor of Go Set. Go Set had finally folded after a very long time. And Ed managed to get another paper going. And he said, look, this time, instead of just writing features and interviews and stuff, why don't you do a column? You know, sort of like Ian Meldrum peeks through keyholes, which I'd always enjoyed very much in Go Set. A gossip column, you know, mention names and mad opinions and everything else. He said, look, you're the most opinionated person I know, so you're not going to have any problem doing this. So he said, why not just do this and you can just expound on everything at great length. And I thought, well, that sounds like fun. And I thought, what will I call it? And I was talking to a friend of mine, Al Watson, who was a jazz fan, as I always was, and he said, why don't you call it Dr. Pepper's Hot Sauce? So I said, where'd you get that from? He said, I don't know where I get Dr. Pepper from, but sauce used to be like the gin, like the gossip, you know, in jazz terms. You know, if you had the sauce, you had to know what was going on. S-A-U-C-E, I should say. So I called it Dr. Pepper's Hot Sauce, and I slowly developed, it just started off really being just a bit of an editorial, but I slowly developed a character known as Dr. Pepper. And I started writing the column in the third person about this crazy guy called Dr. Pepper, who was the maddest guy in Melbourne, who had all these crazy ideas and hit all the venues and talked to everybody and drank like a fish and did tons of drugs, and who was basically the total madman of Melbourne. And this became the most popular thing I ever did. It was amazing. People took to it. People just adored it. It became by far the most popular thing in the magazine. I became a celebrity over it in all sorts of numerous ways. I started doing all sorts of media. I was interviewed for all sorts of papers and radio. But the problem was that I decided initially I'd embellished it, you know, a fair bit, but I started thinking it was more fun to actually do it and then write about it. So I slowly kind of metamorphosed into Dr. Pepper.
Yeah.
It really just became the total exaggeration of the character I developed at Upper Gully State,
yes.
Which is like this mad, kind of loud, funny, wild person. And so I just started becoming Dr. Pepper all the time. And it was difficult to do it as myself, as I'm not really that outrageous, but I found I could fuel it with copious amounts of liquor and drugs. And so I started drinking like a fish. And drink always had an incredibly energetic effect upon me. You know, if I don't drink, I'd always fall asleep about 9 o'clock at night. I was never a night person. But if I drank, I was just going forever.
Yeah.
And the more I drank, the more, you know, the more energetic and wild I became, and the more I was up for anything. So I just became this crazy person who hit about 7 gigs on Friday night, etc., you know, and used to be raging as much as I could go. And I started writing about this, interspersed with all sorts of scurrilous libels about people I didn't like. When I first saw Andy Gibb on Countdown, I was so outraged at how cynical it was that the Gibb brothers thought they could foist their no-talent brother on Australia, you know, and just give him some crappy BG song, and that we would be so suckers that we would take to it, which we did, that I wrote this thing. I said, only in Australia could I, and I put 17 expletives. Finishing up with moron like Andy Gibb get anywhere. So I just started writing this stuff. People just loved it. I remember that the subs at The Truth used to say there were at least 17 actionable libels in every Dr. Pepper column. By this time, the Duke was being run by The Age. They couldn't work how The Age let me get away with it.
So did Dr. Pepper get to the point where you got concerned?
Oh, totally, because my health was starting to collapse. But it was very hard to stop because in some ways it was what I'd always wanted to be. I'd always wanted to be famous and feted and invited to all parts. I got free tickets to everything. I hung out with Keith Moon, with the guys in Yes, the guys in Jethro Tull, the Rolling Stones, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple. You know, I did all the overseas tours because I was the maddest guy in Melbourne, and I was almost known by the time bands got there. They'd say, get Dr. Pepper, he'll show you where the action is.
Yeah.
So I was just, again, if a band came to town, quite often I'd stay in the same hotel as them. By this time also, I'd become very rich because the shop had gone so well, I really had tons of money. And so I was managing to run the shop, plus had this media career. So I really had the freedom to do anything I liked. Quite often, if a band, you know, flew from Melbourne to Sydney, I'd jump on the plane with them and go with them and book it at the same hotel. So if a tour happened, often I'd mole a tour for a whole week. But of course, in the end, yes, my health was starting to suffer tremendously. I was drinking far too much. And I was also thinking like I was just going to wind up dead. I was taking tremendous risks. I was driving in you know, outrageous states. It turned me into this complete mad person.
1976, I believe you bought out Raphael Alias.
That's right. I had a book published of my various writings over the year, again, because I'd become fairly famous, and a publisher decided to produce a book of my work, which was great because it collected a lot of the work I'd done at that time, including poetry and crits and all sorts of ideas. And I was interviewed for the ABC TV show Flashes, and the book actually went quite well. It's quite valuable now. It's quite hard to get. So I wrote the foreword to Graham Webber's book of rock and roll photographs.
Sadly, our time is almost up, and I think what we're going to have to do is come back and revisit both David Pepperell and Dr. Pepper, maybe in some months to come. But can we just try and tie this up? Because there's a lot of years that came after that for your life. But looking back on your life the way it's been, would you have changed anything if you had the opportunity, or would you do it again?
Oh, and I think I'd be pretty much the same. I was fortunate that I had a lot of need to do what I wanted to do. So my mother was determined. I must have got it from her. That I was very determined to be a beatnik, that I was not going to be like my parents. I wasn't going to be middle class like my parents. I disliked their middle class conformity, even though in some ways my dad wasn't a middle class conformist. I didn't like, you know, their liberal voting and their following of Menzies and a lot of that stuff that they did. I was always going to be different. So I was actually drafted, but I got out of that by pretending to be insane. That's another long story. I may tell it sometime in the future. All sorts of stuff like that. So I gravitated to people like me. I wanted to hang out with artists, musicians, clever people, creative people. And so that's what I did. But in the process, I had to produce something myself. I realized that just being the guy who hung out backstage or hung out with people wasn't enough. So I had to create a body of work of my own. So I created writing. I created singing and writing songs. I wrote a number of songs over those years. And I wrote Might Be a Punk for Norman Gunston. I wrote Primal Park for Mondo Rock. I wrote a lot of quite nice songs. So I realized that you did have to produce something. And plus, I produced an enormous amount of journalism, quite a lot of poetry, quite a lot of short story things. So over the years, I felt like you did have to have a product. And I did a lot of radio media work. I was one of the first people ever on Triple R. And I did Triple R for about 15 years. So my life could have been completely the opposite, and maybe that would have been okay, I don't know. But I had a great need, you know, to hang out with people I admired. I loved the music. Music was always the driving force of my life, still is. And so I wanted very much to meet people who played music and find out what they were like.
And you did that.
I did that, yeah. I met most of the people I really like, I really worshipped, really, I did manage to meet.
David Pepperell, alias. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.